Access number 28651, Mr. Victor Berwick, Real 6. Now, you've just remembered something else about Shrivenham, if you want
yes,
to.
Yes, only that one of my fellow cadets was a certain Hammond Innes, the author.
And what was he like then?
Oh, I actually knew him vaguely because his parents lived in Ashford, his father being the bank manager of the Westminster Bank. So I did know him very, very vaguely.
And what was he like as a cadet?
Oh, right, yeah.
Was he a good officer?
I have no idea, really. Actually, he wasn't in my section, so I had no first-hand knowledge. But I do remember reading about him that he started writing his books while in the army, on his spare time.
Now, so the next, you're now second lieutenant. And what was your first posting?
Well, actually, I was sent to a holding unit at Cleethorpes in Lincolnshire.
And how long were you there?
A very short time, actually. We spent our time there with the odd lectures, route marches, PT, and it was just a question of waiting and posting. They had to keep us occupied. And we used to parade every morning on the pier. There's a pier at Cleethorpes, not a very long one. And we're told what the day was going to cover. At any rate, on one particular assembly, the officer in charge of the parade said, before we start, he said, I want two volunteers. He said, there's a local battery, which is short of two officers. And he said, any volunteers here? And I immediately shot my hand up for one of them. And that's how I got, I wasn't actually posted, I just volunteered for the job.
Now, which unit were you going to?
So I was going to the 221 battery, 91st Regiment, which is in my notes there.
It's a heavy anti-aircraft regiment.
That's right, yeah.
Now, what were your first impressions of joining? They were at where?
We were covering Immingham Docks, which was a very vital naval area at the time. The big dockyard area with destroyers and more like the more MTB, motor torpedo boats, which did housing raids across the North Sea.
So where were you actually based in?
So we were based at a village called Healing.
Healing? How do you spell that?
Ordinary Healing. I think, yes, that's right, it is. H-E-A-L-I-N-G. Quite near Grimsby.
And what was the setup there? What guns did they have?
We had 3.7s there.
And what was the gun position like? Was there any differences between the way this battery was organised and your previous...
Well, no. It was a normal setup. Four guns, a command post and so forth, but we were under canvas. And there was normally there were two officers on a gun position. The question of manning, you see, one had to be relieved. And so there was the chap who was there was my... He was a troop officer, and I was under him. But
now, what was your reception like? How did they actually treat you when you arrived?
Well, first of all, the 221 battery was a Yorkshire regiment, 91st, based on York, and so they're all Yorkshiremen, a real mixture of coal miners, a lot of chocolate workers from Roundtrees. I think we were based in New York, and so I had to just settle down.
What was it like being an officer? How did you find it change your perspective?
I think I adapted pretty well. Of course, I was very keen. Something which they'd never done was when during the daylight. Of course, all the days were more or less free. It was a question of training and keeping the men occupied on various jobs, and one of the things which I sort of instituted was some PT sessions, which they never had before. And actually, when we were stationed at Dover, I did a week's course at Connaught Barracks on a PT course, and so I had a good knowledge of what was involved and what to put over, and that went down quite well. Actually, I think it kept them fit too, and me as well.
Now, how else would you fill the day as an officer? I mean, what was a typical day like? We'll look at the night, the action later. What do you remember of it?
We used to get the tea van round most days, organised by some local ladies, and they brought round tea and hot drinks. Of course, we were under canvas, and it was quite chilly. And the odd snacks, which the men could buy.
And now, you'd gone there in September, hadn't you? 41.
That's right, yeah.
Just after, yeah. So you were moving into late autumn and winter.
Yeah. When I say under canvas, the officers were under canvas. The men were already in Nissen huts. But we hadn't got an officer. We had a tent for a mess, and I had a bell tent to myself, which... it was all right, but when the weather set in and the cold weather, I had a Valor oil stove in my tent, and that sent all the heat up to the apex of the tent. And in the morning when I woke up, the half of the tent was glistening white, the lower half, well, the top it was quite free of any ice, so that it was a bit chilly.
Now, what about the mess? What was the officer's mess like?
That was also a tent. But they did build us a proper mess, which had accommodation, sleeping accommodation.
What was it like being an officer? I mean, how formal was it? Was there any sort of guest nights or anything like that going on?
No.
Or was it all just living?
Just living, yeah. We used to go down the road to a cottage, the officers did, to get a hot bath, which used to pay shillings to the lady who I ran it.
Was there much drinking in the regiment? I mean, some regiments are hard drinking officers' messes, some aren't.
Well, it depended on them. You see, but only being two officers, you couldn't run a proper mess. So, but we used to have just the odd bottle of whiskey we bought between us. And although I did. I did find out later that my fellow officer, the one that I joined, was a secret drinker. And how that came about was the fact that when we, earlier before that, I was in the mess, and my other officer, he was somewhere on the site. You know, I had a telephone call from the office, the battery office, which was sighted by the entrance to the site. Just a hut, and that's where the office clerk held court, so to speak. And he rang through to me in the mess, said, "Would you come down to the office?" So I said, "I think Mr. Browning may be inebriated." So I went down there, and there was Browning May flat out, drooped over on the table, just turning over pages of paper. And my problem was, how to get him back to the mess without the men seeing him in that condition. But fortunately, these ladies who brought the hot drinks for us in their van, one was quite a wealthy lady, and she told us earlier on that she had a spare car, which she said, "I can't use because I can't get petrol for it." But she said, "If you can get petrol," said, "you'd have it, because you would then get into Grimsby for any spare time you've got." And so this Ford was duly delivered, and luckily Bombardier Robinson, the clerk who notified me about Browning May's inebriation, his uncle farmed in the area. Uncle's farm was the only people who had surplus petrol coupons, and so via Bombardier Robinson we were able to get petrol for this car. So it was quite a godsend. But to carry on with about the Browning May's inebriation, we had a big rum jar, a big stone jar of rum, which was only issued for during inclement weather periods. It was the night time, it was all night work, and we'd be standing out there possibly hours on end doing nothing, but getting colder and colder, and the instructions just come through via the medical officer of the regiment, that a rum ration could be issued that night. And so we issued this rum was issued out to the men, but it was all diluted with either cocoa, usually cocoa, not neat. And the rum was actually under control of Browning May in his room, you see. And we eventually were told that we weren't to be moved.
Hang on, before we do the move, we need to talk a bit about the place. What about the night raids? What were they like? And your activities at night? What was a typical night like?
Very much as before, really. Barrows work, because the predictor could only still give bearings, couldn't give any other.
Were there many raids?
Not many. Grimsby, although it was a port, it was mainly a big fishing port, really. But no, we had the odd one, but not constant.
And not like Manston or anything.
No. It's all night. We're all done by barrows, by information coming through from the gun operations room. We used to plot the information through on charts and to work out the actual fusing and so forth for the guns.
And if there wasn't a raid, you'd just be on. Would you be on guard?
Yes. If there were enemy activity about, we would be what we call standing to for hours on end, just in case.
And that's when you might get the rum.
Yeah.
Now you said you moved. Was this when you moved? You went
yes,
overseas.
Well, we were due to move to Scunthorpe to take over guns there, because that was a big steel manufacturing area. But when one handed over a gun position, it was quite a process, because you had what they call controlled stores. You got all the equipment and all the binoculars and things of that nature, which were all registered. They had registered the numbers, and there was an inventory of everything, what they call controlled stores, on the site. And these had to be handed over and signed for by the incoming unit. This also included the jar of rum. And when they came to inspect the jar of rum, they found it was empty. And hence the inebriation of Mr. Browning May. It didn't help his record, and he was moved very shortly after that, and I was promoted, so it did me a good turn.
Now, did you actually go to Scunthorpe?
Yes.
No. Now, what happened when you got to Scunthorpe?
Well, yes, things were different there. A, because we moved to a...
Do you know what month it was you went there? It's not in your
notes. No, not really. It would have been... It was winter time, early in the year, I suppose. Difficult to say, because we moved up to Leeds in May, early May, when we started to mobilise for overseas. So it would be in the early part of the year.
So you went to Leeds after school? Now, what happened at school?
We went to a place on the outskirts of Scunthorpe called, excuse me, what's the name of the place? Ashby. Which is called Ashby. And there we had a more advanced stage of radar.
Now tell me about this.
Yes. Now, why it was more advanced is because to be able to get correct height figures through a radar, it had to work on completely level ground. And so they to get the level ground, they built what was called a mat all around the actual radar set. And the mat was comprised of what I would call chicken wire, a mesh. And the Royal Engineers, they erected them, and they covered quite a big area. I imagine could have well be about 75-yard, or no, 50-yard radius around the set. And so the Royal Engineers put in metal struts set in concrete, and then wired all these struts up in form of a lattice work, and everything was completely level. And then over that they stretched the wire netting. And they hadn't quite finished the job when we moved in. And somehow they moved out, and I was there for the job of completing the stretching of the wire netting, or at least my men were, over this mat. So once you got the mat, that then allowed for any returning beam deflect from an aircraft or the radar, sent out a beam reflecting back onto the mat, then bounced off the mat back into the set. From that they could work out an accurate height. So that was the one thing which would enable us to work at night.
So you could actually start aiming at the aircraft again.
Yeah.
Did you have any sound ranging or anything like that? Equipment?
Anyone?
Sound ranging. They used it in the first war.
No. Sound ranging, you go back to World War One. Down the old... So they're still now in position on the coast near...
But you didn't have anything like that?
No, that's all done by acoustics. No, this is all actual radar.
Now, what happened next then? Anything happened at Scunthorpe?
Very, very little in the way of rage. We hadn't finished the actual wire and net, I don't think, but we never were able to use it at night time with the net in action. It was all barrage work. But not much. Although it was a very important area, the steelworks, and it was so visible from above, because the steelworks in operation 24 hours a day, and all the molten slag would be run out at night, glowing as they delivered it onto the heaps, the slag heaps. So it would have been a very good target from above.
So what happened next then?
Next thing was that we were going to be mobilised for going overseas. And we went to Leeds for mobilisation. We did actually take over another site, but I forget where it was, and it was only a matter of days. It was very, very short-lived.
Now, how did you prepare to go overseas?
We were given embarkation leave. That was the first thing. First thing was inoculation for everything you might encounter. Yellow fever. I never been vaccinated for smallpox, so I had a smallpox vaccination. Yellow fever. About four different inoculations. Sand fever was one. Malaria. Anyway, it was a cocktail, and went home on leave, which was, I think, 7 days. And this cocktail rather reacted on me, and I was living at Charing, just outside Ashford at the time, having been bombed out from Ashford. And I was walking with the wife in the woods, and suddenly became very, very faint, and legs started to go, and managed to get back home, and just collapsed, and... And what the docs called general vaccinia, which was the complete sort of the cocktail of drugs that just sort of upset my whole system. And so I was delirious for 2 days, and I thought quite like I would miss the draft. But you know, I recovered fairly quickly and was able to report in due course.
Any other preparations made?
Were
you given any kit, a different kit?
Yes, we were at Leeds. We were then kitted out with tropical kit, including a solar topi, which we never used.
Now, what was tropical kit entirely? I mean,
well, it purely a light form of khaki shorts, and I don't think we had any not long trousers. I think we were just shorts. That's all. And also lightweight tunics, and we still had the normal battle dress, of course. We retained that, and we had these solar topies, which you've probably seen pictures of, the big what they call a pith helmet. Never used them. It was a complete waste of money, because they were just dumped.
And anything else that happened? Any other preparations for going overseas?
No.
Did you know where you were going? I know you'd had tropical kit, but, you know...
Well, we knew we were going out to the Middle East. We thought, yeah, Middle East, it must have been. Of course, I'm not sure the Japanese had come into the war at that stage. They hadn't. No, they hadn't.
No,
it was going to be definitely Middle East. And so we were trained in due course up to the Clyde.
Now, what ship did you go aboard?
We were on the Commodore ship, which was leading the convoy, which was rather nice. We had I forget what his rank was. He was commander or something. But he was the chap in leading the convoy.
And what was the ship called?
Orcades, Orcades. It was part of the Orient Line in those days, which eventually merged with the P&O, both the Peninsula and Oriental Line. But it was a very new ship, only launched in 1937, so we were very, very fortunate.
Now, were you taking your guns, or...?
No. Purely manpower. We had 5,000 troops on our boat, which was 23,000 tonnes, I think, was the tonnage.
Now, what were conditions... This is in May 1941. What
42, sorry.
What were conditions like during the voyage? Was it overcrowded?
Officers were good, but all the lower decks had been completely cleared of anything in the way of fittings, so the men slept on what they called the mess decks, slung in hammocks. And there were hooks up on the ceilings on which these hammocks were slung, and we had 5,000 on board, and of course one of the jobs of duty officers was going around at night time to make sure that everything's okay, because these mess decks were below the waterline, so all portholes were sealed, and the smell that was coming from the men during that night period was appalling. And the only ventilation they had were air blowers fixed in the ceiling, these nozzles which were pumping in sort of warm air. But it was pretty foul, and much so, it was so foul that the men, in their letters which they were writing home, were complaining about the officers living in luxury in their cabins. Well, they were in rather sort of not the best of conditions below decks. And of course, the mail was going to be collected at Durban. We didn't know we were going to Durban, but that work was going to be collected. They were writing letters which were going to be taken off board then. But so, being an officer, one of the jobs was censoring mail. You had to cut out anything which might have been of injurious to the nation.
Now, what was it like censoring their mail? What sort of letters would they write? Was there much in that you had to censor?
Well, the one thing which we had to scrub out was anything about their conditions and what their feelings were about the officers having a better time of life. But it was understood.
Were the letters sometimes amusing or sad?
No.
What happened on the? Which way did you go?
Well, first of all, we set sail from the Clyde. There were 22 ships in the convoy. We moved down from our berth down into the estuary of the Clyde for the formation for the convoy to form. And it was a big convoy. Yeah, there were 22 ships. And they were all big ships. Most of them were carrying troops, and a lot were carrying equipment. It was a very, very important convoy. Of course, we had a terrific escort. We had two battleships, the Nelson on our port bow, the Rodney on the starboard side, and then a bit astern was an aircraft carrier called the Argus, which was an old converted liner. And then we had six destroyers, three on each flank. But we were fortunate when we left the Clyde that we had atrocious weather conditions. It was very low cloud, very rough weather, and that lasted for quite a few days. and it did enable us to get way out into the Atlantic before we got any fine weather. And that, well, the godsend being, of course, that the Germans were carrying out reconnaissance flights in what the type of aircraft they used, the Condor, four-engine, long-range Condors, where they used to spot any convoy and then, of course, radio to their submarines in the area, who could then hone in on a convoy. We had one or two alerts in, later on when the destroyers went into action, but nothing happened to the convoy. They were dropping depth charges and things, but nothing attacked us.
And what about seasickness? Was that a problem with the bad weather?
I was only seasick once. That was after an evening meal. When I recognised one of the stewards who were serving us, not myself, but I spotted him across the room. And I said to Astor, "Is that man over there, is his name Bishop?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I've been in the Boy Scouts with." So I said, "Well, tell him Vic Berwick's on the cabin so and so." And he made himself known. And I shared the cabin with two other officers. And he said, I'll take your mail home for you. So instead of going through the army post, which were taking weeks and weeks, we changed ships at Durban. And he took it back and he delivered it to my wife. But before that, of course, we knew we were going, we thought we were going right across to the other side of the Atlantic. Of course, the time zones kept changing. And we knew we were going a long way to the west. And then suddenly we started going in reverse. It was peculiar, but we went up into Freetown. Of course, the point being that it was a question of water. They couldn't carry enough water and other supplies for the whole trip. The only ship that was with us that went on its own was Aquitania. And she had 10,000 troops on board. And she left us sometime during the voyage, just haired off unescorted. And she got the speed and she got the, but she couldn't carry enough water for the speed of our convoy. So she went off full speed and went to the Cape. And that was where she called in to refuel and take on water and supplies. And she got through all right.
Anything else about the voyage?
No, except that once we got to Freetown, the whole convoy was hit by a bug, something like enteritis. And we were the last ship to get it. But it was very virulent. The men suffered diarrhea, and they were all lying on the decks. The mess decks were out of bounds. They just laid on the decks with buckets between them. And we asked to send some of our medical supplies to these ships who were suffering. And then it suddenly struck us we were the last ship to get it. And we were rather running short of our own supplies. So our men had to rather put up with what was left, I'm afraid. But it was quite a messy business, to say the least.
Did you get it?
Nope, I did not. But it's mainly with the men.
And this was enteritis, you reckon? Or?
Yes, it was diarrhea and sickness.
And where were you going?
We didn't know. We called it Durban, first of all, and trained ships there. And the Orcades went back unescorted to UK to pick up fresh troops and so forth. And that's when Les Bishop delivered my letter to my wife. He said he's got as far as Durban, and that's as far as I know. And incidentally, the Orcades was sunk off the Cape after that next trip. It's going back unescorted, and the Jap sub caught it, and it was sunk. And Bishop told me when I saw him later after the war that only two of the crew were lost, and that was the chief engineer, who was down below, and a nurse who went back on the ship to collect her fur coat. But otherwise, the whole of the crew were rescued in the boats.
Now, you went ashore at Durban, or did you just transship?
No, we went ashore. We went inland to a racetrack called Clarewood, where we were on the canvas for a couple of days, two or three days. And the first thing we were warned about was ants. termites said that they eat anything. We, you know, we thought it was a bit odd, but anyway, we didn't suffer. I said they like army equipment, which I thought a bit much.
But you didn't notice them?
No. It was, we went to, we were out of evening leave. We went up by train. It was a few miles inland. We were not too far. And so the officers, I'm not sure about the men. I think they were allowed very limited leave, but the officer had a bit more, of course, nothing to do, you see, in this camp. And so another officer and I, we went in one evening, and we wanted to get a drink, you see. There was no drink available, not in this camp. And we tried to find a bar. Anyway, we couldn't find a bar. They were all shut. So we saw a man coming down the street, and we accosted him and explained our position. Where could we get a drink? Because all the bars are shut. He said, yes, yes. Why they're shut is the fact that there are black American troops in the town, and in America, black troops can go into bars and get drinks, but not with the local population being black here. He said it would cause a riot. If they saw black troops getting drinks, they couldn't. And so everything shut down. But he said, I'll recommend you go to my club. And he gave us the address of the Mercantile Club. And said he'd go up the certain floor and went up by lift. And he said, make yourself known and you'll be made welcome. And we were. And one of the first people I met